Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop and today's program is a treatment update on mantle cell lymphoma. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations and blood cancer organizations and lymphoma organizations as well. And we really want to thank them all for working with us to make this program possible and helping to spread the word about the program. Now, we have on the program today over 690 participants, and you come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, China, France, Italy, Ireland, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us, and we really take our hats off to you for your doing this. Today's program is supported by the Celgene Corporation and an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC. I really want to thank them for their support of the program today and also for their corporate collaboration in making today's program possible. And we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Bron Kahl. And Dr. Kahl is Professor of Medicine, Washington University School of Medicine, Director of Lymphoma Program, Siteman Cancer Center. Dr. Kahl is going to present an overview of mantle cell lymphoma, treatment options for newly diagnosed, and communicating with healthcare team about emerging treatment options. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Kahl.
Thank you, Carolyn, and welcome everybody on the call. It's a pleasure to have this opportunity to present along with Dr. Haberman. So I'm going to start out by talking to you just a little bit about an overview of mantle cell lymphoma, and then I'll talk about how we think about managing mantle cell lymphoma in the frontline setting, meaning people's initial treatment to mantle cell lymphoma. So mantle cell lymphoma is a form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Non-Hodgkin's is sort of a broad term. There are many, many kinds of non-Hodgkin lymphoma, about 60 actually. You also might hear the term B-cell lymphoma. And most non-Hodgkin's lymphoma are in the category of a B-cell lymphoma. That means that the original cell in the body that turned into a lymphoma cell was called a B lymphocyte. And B lymphocytes have a normal job to do in our bodies. They're part of our immune system. So mantle cell lymphoma is a B cell lymphoma, a form of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it has a characteristic genetic abnormality, which is a translocation between two different chromosomes, chromosome 11 and chromosome 14. You might hear that when you talk to the doctor, the 14-11 translocation, and this abnormality within the cancer cells results in overexpression of a protein called cyclin D1. And so years ago, mantle cell lymphoma was a little bit tricky to diagnose, but now with new technology and new tests, we can test biopsy material for this 11-14 translocation, and we can test the biopsy material for this cyclin D1 protein. And diagnosing mantle cell lymphoma is actually relatively straightforward and simple in 2017, and most cases straightforward. So clinically, mantle cell lymphoma has some unique features. It's much more common in men compared to women, and we don't really understand the reason for that. The average age for a newly diagnosed mantle cell lymphoma patient is right around 65, although we certainly see patients in all age groups. We'll see patients as young as in their 30s and 40s with mantle cell lymphoma, and we'll see people into their 80s and 90s with a new diagnosis of mantle cell lymphoma. Most people diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma have what we call advanced stage disease. And the reason is mantle cell lymphoma tends to be a disease that involves the blood and the bone marrow. So if you think about it, a disease that's circulating in your blood is widespread by definition. And I want to emphasize the fact that having stage 4 mantle cell lymphoma is normal, it's typical, and it doesn't really confer a worse prognosis. In other words, this is not analogous to having stage 4 lung cancer or stage 4 pancreatic cancer. Stage 4 mantle cell lymphoma, which is what most people have, is very treatable and very manageable and not much different than having stage 2 or stage 3 disease. We often find it in the blood. We often find it in the bone marrow. We often find it in the gastrointestinal tract. So if you look in the stomach or in the colon, it's very common to find mantle cell lymphoma in those locations. The disease is generally regarded as moderately aggressive. It is a disease that we are unable to cure, we think, with standard drugs. But I will say that the treatments that we have for mantle cell lymphoma have improved markedly over the past 15 years, and outcomes are substantially better than they were in the past. So there is a lot of variety in how a mantle cell lymphoma might behave from one individual to another. We call this heterogeneity within the disease. And there are some things we can measure that will tell us if the disease is going to be more slow-moving or more fast-moving in an individual person. And factors associated with better outcomes include a low proliferation rate that can be tested on the biopsy, younger age, good performance status, that just means general health, a normal LDH, which is lactate dehydrogenase, that's a simple blood test, and a normal white blood cell count. All those things are associated with better outcomes in mantle cell lymphoma, and we check all those things when we have a newly diagnosed patient. Sometimes those factors will influence our decision-making regarding treatment, and sometimes, frankly, they will not influence our factors regarding what treatment we're going to recommend to an individual patient. Once we have a patient who's newly diagnosed, one of the jobs is to complete the staging evaluation. Usually the patients have had a biopsy of either a lymph node or a blood test or a bone marrow biopsy. Some patients present to the physician with symptoms. Some people, mantle cell lymphoma is just found incidentally on a routine checkup. Staging will involve the blood test that I mentioned, the bone marrow evaluation. We usually do imaging in the form of a PET scan. A CT scan would be adequate as well, although PET scan seems to be a little more sensitive for staging mantle cell lymphoma. I personally don't get, I don't perform the endoscopies, the upper and lower endoscopies in most patients. Some physicians will do that. I just assume most people have involvement of their GI tract. It's usually at a microscopic level, and I don't put patients through that procedure, but some physicians will do that. So let's talk for a few minutes about the management strategies of a newly diagnosed mantle cell lymphoma. The first point I want to make is that it is occasionally okay and appropriate to do what we call watch and wait, which means not treat it initially. The scenario where that would be acceptable would be a patient where the mantle cell lymphoma was found incidentally. In other words, the patient feels perfectly fit, perfectly healthy. It was just found, maybe picked up on routine blood work, or a small lymph node was noted on a physical examination. Patient feels fine, and after the full staging evaluation is done, it's determined that the patient has a very low tumor burden. And by tumor burden, I mean if you took all the lymphoma cells out of the patient's body and made a pile, how big is the pile? And some patients have a very low tumor burden at diagnosis. And if the disease doesn't look very proliferative under the microscope, and if they don't have any of the adverse prognostic features that I mentioned earlier, and the tumor burden is low, and the patient is asymptomatic, it is okay to start that patient on a strategy of watch and wait. That allows the physician and the patient to sort of learn about that person's individual case of mantle cell lymphoma because it behaves differently in everybody. And some people can go for years with no treatment, and that's the reason that we'll sometimes start folks on that strategy. Now, admittedly, that's a minority of patients who are candidates for that approach, maybe 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 patients are appropriate for that kind of a strategy, so it won't be commonly utilized, but occasionally. More typical is that a patient comes in and they have symptoms, or they were found to have a relatively high tumor burden, and starting on treatment needs to happen relatively soon. So my own approach to patients is to look at whether they're going to be a candidate for what we call intensive treatments, and these are typically younger or healthier patients. Intensive treatments generally produce longer first remissions of mantle cell lymphoma, and that's why we'll often offer that to younger patients. However, older patients, and defining older gets a little tricky. My own personal cutoff for when patients are appropriate for intensive treatment is usually around age 65. Some people will use a cutoff more like age 60. Some people use a cutoff more like age 70. These are not hard and fast rules. These are just guidelines. But in general, as folks get older, intensive treatments are tolerated less well by the patient. And it's perhaps not always worth it to put the patient through such an intensive treatment if they're going to experience a lot of toxicity from it and have a drop-off in their quality of life. So we have some very good non-intensive treatments that we can recommend for our older mantle cell patients. And occasionally we'll have patients who are right on the fence. Maybe they're 64 years old, and that's when I'll try to look at things like their prognostic score, using those factors that I mentioned earlier, or the proliferation rate on the biopsy, and that can help sort of get us off the fence in deciding whether to be intensive or less intensive with our treatment. So what are some examples of less intensive treatment strategies that we might recommend to an older mantle cell patient? So I think the most commonly utilized initial treatment for older mantle cell patients would be a combination, a two-drug combination of a chemotherapy drug called bendamustine combined with a drug called rituximab. Bendamustine is a chemotherapy drug that works very well in mantle cell lymphoma. It's pretty well tolerated. The side effects are, frankly, not that bad as far as chemotherapy goes. The rituximab is usually very well tolerated by patients. Rituximab is a monoclonal antibody that kind of helps trick the patient's immune system into help fighting the cancer. And using that particular combination, that will get about 90% of patients into remission and about 60% of patients into complete remission. So we can get most people in remission with a six-month course of bendamustine and rituximab. Some investigators or treating clinicians will use other types of initial therapy. Some patients will use the R-CHOP regimen, which is a very standard, commonly used lymphoma regimen in other lymphomas. There's a regimen called VR-CAP, which is a spinoff of the R-CHOP regimen and uses a drug called bortezomib, and that was shown to be somewhat better than R-CHOP in a big head-to-head trial. There are some sort of novel, innovative combinations that can be used. For example, there was an interesting publication came out a little over a year ago looking at a combination of the drugs lenalidomide and rituximab. And in a small study, that looked promising in mantle cell lymphoma. But I find most individuals who use the bendamustine-rituximab regimen, which will put the majority of patients into remission. And then kind of an area of controversy right now is whether patients should receive so-called maintenance therapy after they've completed their bendamustine and rituximab. There are some studies that show maintenance therapy is beneficial in older mantle cell patients, but those patients had received the R-CHOP regimen, and it's really unproven whether rituximab maintenance is beneficial after the bendamustine-rituximab regimen. And there was actually one small study presented last year at a meeting suggesting it's not beneficial. And so the world is a bit divided right now, and some physicians are not offering maintenance rituximab after bendamustine rituximab, and some are. I happen still to be offering it to my patients, but I admit that this is an area of uncertainty. And then there are some important clinical trials underway looking to see if we can improve the results that we achieve with bendamustine rituximab and rituximab maintenance. An example would be a trial we just did in the U.S. Cooperative Groups where we are testing the addition of the drug bortezomib to the bendamustine rituximab and testing the addition of the drug lenalidomide to the rituximab maintenance. And so we hope to have answers from that important clinical trial in the next year to 2 years, and that could change some of our recommendations. Switching gears to talk for a minute about intensive approaches that we might pursue in younger mantle cell patients. There are a variety of reasonable options here. There's not one universally accepted standard. So examples of some intensive treatments that we might offer younger mantle cell patients would be something like the HyperCVAD regimen that was developed at MD Anderson. There are some centers that are very comfortable using that in mantle cell. Another commonly used regimen is a regimen called R-CHOP with alternating R-DHAP. So these are two different chemotherapy regimens, and they're alternated every 3 weeks as to which one the patient gets. And after 6 cycles of that, that is followed by an autologous stem cell transplant. And an autologous stem cell transplant in mantle cell lymphoma is a procedure where you harvest stem cells from the patient after they're in remission. You put those stem cells in a freezer, and then you bring the patient in for one more round of high-dose chemotherapy, attempting to kill the last remaining stubborn mantle cells that were not killed by the regular chemotherapy. And the doses of chemotherapy are so high with this, it's called conditioning regimen, that we give the patient their own stem cells back to help their body recover from the side effects of the high-dose chemotherapy. And this kind of a strategy of the chemotherapy followed by the autologous stem cell transplantation can produce very long remissions in mantle cell lymphoma. It's unclear whether this is a curative approach. We think generally not. By 10 years, most of the patients will have had a recurrence, but there are certainly some patients who are still in remission 10-plus years after these sorts of procedures, and it's frankly hard to know whether these patients could be cured or not. But we're careful, we're cautious about using the cure word because we're not sure, and it's hard to know how confident to be. But we know we can achieve very long remissions with that kind of approach. Another commonly used regimen is the so-called Nordic regimen, which is similar to the regimen I just described, and it involves getting an autologous stem cell transplant at the end of the induction chemotherapy. And again, it produces very long first remissions in mantle cell lymphoma. Now, admittedly, it's a hard year, the year of treatment that the patients have to go through, the 6 months of induction therapy and the stem cell transplant, and then the recovery from the stem cell transplant. It is a hard year for those patients. But if we can get them a nice long remission that lasts 5, 7, 10, 12 years, that's an excellent outcome that gives the patient all that time free of treatment, free of intensive treatment anyway. It gives your doctor 7 or 10 or 12 years to find new and better ways to treat mantle cell lymphoma so that if the disease does come back down the road, we'll have even more and better options than we had at the beginning. And so I view that as a very good goal and a good outcome. The last thing I'll say, there was just some data presented at a big international meeting last month that looked at the role of maintenance rituximab after autologous stem cell transplantation. This data suggests a very significant benefit for maintenance rituximab. It improves the length of the remission, and this data suggests it also improves the probability of being alive 2 years later, 3 years later, 5 years later after the stem cell transplant. So I do think most of the world will start giving maintenance rituximab after stem cell transplant procedures based on this newly presented data. And with that, I think I'll stop and turn it over to Dr. Haberman, who's going to talk to you about treatment options in the relapsed and refractory setting.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Kahl. That was really outstanding and a lot of information for everybody, so I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Haberman. Dr. Haberman is Professor of Medicine at Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, and he is going to be addressing treatment options for relapsed refractory disease, the role of clinical trials, and quality of life concerns. It's now my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Haberman.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'm very humbled to be here with everyone. Hard to believe there are 690 sites worldwide, and it's very always great to be with Dr. Call. With regard to the treatment options for relapse and refractory disease, there are a phenomenal number of options out there after relapse that weren't there 5 to 10 years ago, and new therapeutic interventions continue to be reported very frequently now. Patients can live a very long period of time. I now have a number of patients out over 15 years who have relapsed within a couple of years of an initial autologous transplant, so there's tremendous hope. There are, in the United States, four agents that have been approved over time, temsirolimus, bortezomib, lenalidomide, and ibrutinib, and these have all been over the last 10 years. The results with single-agent bortezomib, which now is involved with the combination regimens, the patients, about a third of patients had responses that lasted a significant period of time. Lenalidomide came on after that, around 2009, we reported the initial report, and there were subsequently many other studies that then addressed this in international efforts. And the overall response rates were around, again, a third. And the interesting thing about this drug is it produces a rapid response. So the median time to respond is about 2 months. And so this is very helpful. We know that there is some risk with lenalidomide in developing other cancers. The risk is around 3%. That's undergoing extensive studies. And now, as Dr. Call mentioned, both in the initial treatment and in the relapse refractory setting, lenalidomide is being combined with a number of agents, bortezomib, bendamustine, dexamethasone, rituximab, bendamustine, rituximab, bortezomib with lenalidomide, rituximab, and so forth. There are a tremendous number of ongoing international trials, and many of the countries listed today on the call do have ongoing opportunities and studies. The drug that changed things rather significantly was ibrutinib when it was initially reported in 2012 and subsequently came out in the New England Journal in 2013, and basically, 68% and 67% of patients responded to this agent, and complete remission rates improved from 3.5% at 2 months up to 21% at 15 months. And this drug is now out in randomized studies up front. If one progresses on ibrutinib, you can respond. There have been different publications, one of which reported over 205 responses with other treatment regimens. Of interest at the American Society of Hematology meeting, which just occurred in December, and Dr. Call was alluding to a couple studies that came out of there. A study came out of the MD Anderson group, which talked about the effectiveness of lenalidomide after patients relapsed or progressed after ibrutinib, and again, about a third of patients responded. So that if you do relapse after ibrutinib, there is really some other things that can be done definitely. We've looked and reported on everolimus. About a third of patients responded to this drug, and this is another drug that's available. It's a breast cancer drug. It's not FDA approved. And bendamustine or rituximab, if you didn't get that up front, Dr. Churchman and his colleagues reported back in 2012 an overall response rate of 82%, which was really quite significant. And the times, the duration of response was quite significant also. And the toxicities weren't terribly bad. As far as coming out of our national meeting this year, a drug is new to the scene, alpelisib, And this drug is what's called a CDK4/CD6 inhibitor. It's an oral agent too, just like lenalidomide, just like ibrutinib. And in 20 patients, two-thirds of patients with very aggressive relapsed refractory disease responded. And this is extremely exciting and came out of bench research, some of which was also supported by the Lymphoma Research Foundation out of a faculty member at Cornell. There are other new drugs in that same class coming. There's studies underway with venetoclax. There's studies underway with other antibodies, anti-CD38 antibodies. There are tumomab, and other drugs are underway, including looking at nivolumab. And unfortunately, there's very little data out there. This is a drug that's very active in lung cancer and very active in Hodgkin lymphoma. The CAR T cell story, there are patients who have been treated. The overall response rates are looking at about 50%, but the numbers of patients treated on the clinical trials at this time with mantle cell lymphoma are quite small. Lastly, allogeneic transplant has been reported in the MD Anderson group, reported that at 10 years follow-up, the overall survival was rather remarkable in well over a third of patients, and with 47% of patients had no relapses after 5 years. And so this is a potential opportunity. However, in allogeneic transplant, the real issue is that there is a 25% mortality rate in the first 3 months, and we really haven't improved upon that the last 30 years. Another option that can be considered in patients with very large spleens is to take the spleen out. And there have been different scattered reports of this. We recorded some a fairly large series twice. And this can be something that can be considered in very selected patients. So the second aspect of your question is what about the role of clinical trials? I think there's no question that the data discussed by Dr. Call demonstrates how randomized clinical trials in mantle cell lymphoma are defining the treatments and the standards of care internationally. I think, secondly, there's no question that we are all believing each other's data. Thirdly, there's a lot of participation by multiple centers internationally on different trials, and so things have changed rather remarkably over the last, especially this last decade. So what about in the relapsed refractory setting? We had an abstract that we presented at the big cancer meeting, the ASCO meeting, the largest one in the world, last summer, and we looked at our Mayo Clinic lymphoma database from 2001 to 2014, because it wasn't until around 2001 that really the trials started coming and so forth, and we looked at 156 consecutive mantle cell patients that we followed carefully and closely here. And 41% of them went on clinical trials. The median age was 65. And in the group of patients who went on to clinical trials versus those that didn't, and this was not randomized, but they didn't have the opportunities to, they weren't enrolled, but they were eligible. And we were very careful to look at that. There was a significant improvement in the overall survival long-term and at 2 years. And this is some of the real strong evidence to suggest how important clinical trials can be. I think mantle cell, we've been lucky. There have been a lot of different things that have come along the pipeline over the last 5 to 10 years. But this is really intriguing, and I think really a strong suggestion that going on clinical trials, if there is the opportunity, can really potentially offer something. So lastly, what about quality of life concerns? we're starting to understand the long-term follow-up issues in lymphomas. In this last meeting at the American Society of Hematology, in mantle cell lymphoma and non-Hodgkin lymphoma, there were some very interesting abstracts presented. We're now looking at comorbidity scoring systems. We're beginning to have much better understanding of the risk of death of heart disease and other types of cancers 2 years after the diagnosis, and the risk of other types of skin cancer. And so it's really important that you be followed up for these things and not just ignore the other aspects of your health if you have lymphoma, and to make sure that your doctor is doing so or that your doctor is getting you to see somebody along the way. What's a comorbidity? A comorbidity is the presence of one or more additional diseases or disorders that are co-occurring with your lymphoma. And there's a scoring, there are different scoring systems. One's called the Charlton Comorbidity Index Scoring System, where if you have heart, lung, or dementia issues, you get 1 point. If you have neurologic disorders or kidney diseases or leukemia, 2 points. And if you have significant liver disease, 3 points, and then metastatic solid tumor or AIDS, 6 points. And there's a very fascinating paper by Dr. Andre Guo, who's done a lot in lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma and other aspects of lymphoma. But they looked at the results of 490 patients treated with an array of regimens, and the 5-year overall survival, if you had the 0 to 3 Charlton index, was 90%, and it was significantly lower if you did have some of those issues. And so this is really telling us in a quantitative way that other aspects of health are important contributors to the long-term outcomes and have very significant impacts, and we really can't ignore those things. There's another large abstract on looking at late morbidity mortality among 2-year survivors with non-Hodgkin lymphoma that included mantle cell lymphoma in patients over the age of 67 years. There are 11,000 patients in this year linked with Medicare claims study, and if you had heart disease, you didn't do as well. If you had congestive heart failure, you didn't do as well. And there was also a significant increased risk of lung cancer and prostate cancer. And so, again, what this is telling us is how important the rest of your health is and to be have close long-term follow-up. Lastly, there was a very interesting skin cancer abstract by the NCI group, Dr. Lindsay Morton, who's very internationally respected. And there's a higher risk of melanoma and Merkel cell tumors in patients with mantle cell lymphoma in the SEER database. And again, the importance of if you develop new skin lesions that are growing, you really need to have them checked and managed. So with this, I really want to thank you for your interest in this meeting, your participation, and look forward to your questions. I'm most grateful to Carolyn, the LRF, the industry support, and to all the patients, the nurses, the administrators who have participated in so many ways. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Haberman. That was really wonderful and very comprehensive. And I think there being lots of different components of people's health, so people have a bigger picture of their well-being and also their utilizing their health care the most, all the different conditions that they need to, so thank you. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. The questions are already coming in, so here we have it. And our next speaker is Ms. Essie Roman. Ms. Roman is an oncology social worker, and she's Cancer Care Women's Clinic Program Coordinator. And Ms. Roman is going to present to you on Cancer Care's 3 psychosocial services and programs, as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Essie.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a pleasure to be a part of this Connect Education Workshop. I would like to start by talking about the importance of having support when you're diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma and how cancer care and our hope lines can be of help to you. As we have learned from today's workshop, there is a lot of information about mantle cell lymphoma to take in, and sometimes it's hard to understand what this means for you. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer, like mantle cell lymphoma, affects a person, their family, partners, and friends. We are also trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle the problems that come along with the disease, such as practical and financial demands, physical changes, and the social and emotional impact of mantle cell lymphoma. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis of mantle cell lymphoma is an important part of your journey that you don't have to face alone. Cancer care can help in many ways, such as our practical and financial help. We can also refer you to other financial assistance resources. Our emotional support services are provided by licensed oncology social workers in a variety of settings, such as telephone counseling, online and telephone support groups. We realize that cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by contacting a cancer care social worker for counseling or by joining a support group is a sign of strength. Counseling can help you explore the tools you need in order to cope. For many people living with cancer, telling a social worker relieves the stress of holding it all inside and shielding loved ones from their struggle. Cancer Care offers a wide variety of support groups as well. In addition to offering support groups for people with cancer, we also offer support groups for family members, partners, and caregivers. Many people find being in a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. Individual counseling and support groups are a safe place where you can talk about your concerns and fears. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people experience. Feeling emotionally well can help you better deal with your diagnosis of mantle cell lymphoma and the treatment you face. All our services are provided completely free of charge. If you would like to speak with an oncology and social worker, please contact our helpline at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org for more information. In addition, as you know, our Connect education workshops provide both disease-specific information, such as today's workshop, and workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impact of cancer. Our fact sheets and booklets are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help people diagnosed with cancer and those who care for them. These two additional tools that can be of help. Again, all of these materials are available free of charge. Please remember that you are not alone. While we may not be able to eliminate the problems you experience, we are here for you, and Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Roman. That was wonderful and really an excellent explanation of all the different services that people can access from Cancer Care. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board. And I'm going to also ask Stephanie to explain to you how to queue up for questions, although some of you already seem to know how to do this for the online part of it. Stephanie will tell all of you how to queue up for questions so you can be sure to get to all of your questions. And if we don't get to a question of yours, I will at the end of the program let you all know how to get your questions answered. But let's just see how many we can take right now. Now, Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, please press star then 1 to ask a question.
So we have some questions from some of our online participants. So let me actually start with the first one. So the first question, which I'm going to give to Dr. Kyle to begin with, is how long would you continue with the toxin after tumors have shrunk and stabilized, almost disappeared? Initial treatment was 3 years of Revlimid, starting at 25 milligrams and ending with 5 milligrams. And again, Dr. Kyle, if you could just address this question in a general way, and we hope then Peter will take us back to his treating healthcare team, but just to give some general guidance for everybody on the call regarding this question.
Sure. Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's I wish I could give a simple, straightforward answer to that question, but it just reflects areas of uncertainty and what we don't know about the optimal duration of maintenance rituximab. And so many of the trials that have used maintenance rituximab picked an arbitrary stop date of 2 years, so that's a commonly utilized strategy. The trial that I mentioned in my talk that showed a benefit for maintenance rituximab after stem cell transplantation that was presented at the meeting last month used it for 3 years. So that's the first time we've seen data for that particular duration. There was one trial in which which showed a benefit, big benefit for maintenance, in which the rituximab was given indefinitely, meaning until disease progression or patient intolerance or patient or physician preference for stopping the drug. So just indefinite maintenance. And there are certainly some physicians who do it that way, the indefinite maintenance. I personally don't do it that way. I had run a few studies in which we did the maintenance for 5 years in mantle cell and in another lymphoma called follicular lymphoma. And we started to note a certain amount of maintenance fatigue from the patients, from the caregivers, from the providers. We started to see more problems with infections than we were comfortable with. And so in my own practice, I have been using the 2 years and stopping arbitrarily at 2 years. After transplant, I will follow the 3-year paradigm as was just presented. So I'm just telling you what I do in my own practice, but I'm admitting that other clinicians have other durations of maintenance that they use in their practices, and there isn't really a clear-cut right or wrong answer to any of those at this time.
Okay. Thank you. And our next question, for our online participants, for Dr. Habermann. In the first relapse of MCL, is there any advantage of using ibrutinib or lenalidomide first? Again, he's going to say check away, of course.
I think in the first relapse, if you have access to both drugs in your country, then I would favor proceeding with ibrutinib because the response rates are twice what they are with lenalidomide. We initially reported a 53% response rate, but it's really closer to 30% in much more expanded studies. And the ibrutinib responses are longer. The true length of response and so forth is still under study because these studies haven't been going on that long. And our practice, and I think the practice of many individuals, if you were treated off study with the ibrutinib first, then lenalidomide a second.
And we have another question, which I'm going to ask Dr. Kalf to start with, but I think Dr. Habermann, you may also wish to weigh on as well. The question is, I have a JAK3 genetic mutation and PRDM1 mutation. And mantle cell lymphoma, what does that mean? So Dr. Kalashi, could I discuss that in a general way?
I'll try. That's a hard one to know what the implications of that are. The idea of doing sequencing of the tumor cells is relatively recent within the past few years, and this is a field that is literally growing up before our eyes. And the idea about what to do with certain findings in these mutation analyses is a moving target. So occasionally we will find a mutation in a patient that would suggest a certain biochemical pathway is deranged in that patient's cancer cells, and that might lead you to try one particular therapy over another. There are some large studies being done in the United States trying to pick therapies for patients using those very strategies. A trial called MATCH, for example, does that, and there are others. So there is a pathway that's called the JAK-STAT pathway, And so there might be some agents that might be beneficial in a mantle cell case that has a JAK mutation that wouldn't be beneficial in others. And that's how that information could be utilized in a general way. And actually, I would love to hear Tom's perspective on this evolving area in lymphoma as well.
I think Brad's answered it very well. We've been involved in trials in studies more in large cell lymphoma with microarray and then with the whole genome, whole exome sequencing, and had a lot of grants on this. And the whole issue is that when you find these, that they're there to really say that these are functional or not in your individual disease is still a question. I was just looking at the 1001 study. It's in large cell lymphoma, but actually I don't see either of those on the slide. And there's a fair amount of overlap in different histologies in lymphoma. And so I wouldn't know what to say and what to suggest to you as far as those. You do get printouts when they go into foundation medicine and to other realms suggesting that drugs may have some impact downstream or upstream from these mutations. But I haven't seen anyone with this, and we don't have any data in our own experience with these two, either in large cell or mantle cell.
These are wonderful questions. I have to say it's a very good questions for our audience. There's another question, actually, from one of our online participants who comes in. Some doctors offer, and actually I'm going to give this question to Dr. Habibin, I think. Some doctors offer ibrutinib frontline for MCL off-label. There's a concern of ibrutinib resistance and poor prognosis after ibrutinib fails. One doctor told me this only applies to relapse refractory use of ibrutinib, but this would not be the case using ibrutinib frontline. Can you please comment on this?
I'll ask Brad for his comments also.
Okay.
My first take on this is we don't really know the answer. If the original paper didn't come out or abstract till 2012, then published in 2013. And there are now randomized studies. There's a tremendous amount of money that's being put into randomized studies with ibrutinib internationally. And I honestly don't think we know. There was a real concern in chronic lymphocytic leukemia about how refractory things were. I think what was really fascinating was the only evidence they really know of a way to respond to this question is the lenalidomide abstract I mentioned at ASH this year, where the response rates were just what they were in our original work. So about a third of patients responded, and with ibrutinib, a third of patients responded. Ibrutinib relapsed, a third of patients responded. And so I don't think we know. And I tend to be a little more data-driven sometimes and don't do things that up front that haven't really been tested and are FDA-approved. And I'd be interested in Brad's response.
Yeah. So Tom and I tend to think alike on these things, and I feel similarly. So I personally am not comfortable right now using ibrutinib in the front line, unless it was part of a clinical trial in which the data was being collected prospectively and analyzed so that we come out of it with more knowledge and we've learned something. What the question said was true, that when ibrutinib is used in the relapse setting, we do see some patients whose disease breaks through the ibrutinib in a very explosive way, and it can be very hard to find effective treatments for those patients. And to be honest, we have no idea what happens in the frontline setting because it has not been tested in a systematic way. So we really can't. That's a very good question, but it is unanswerable at this point in time.
And, Excellent. Good questions here. Excellent questions. Yeah. Wow. Okay. And we have another question from one of our online participants from Peter. Follow-up information to Revlimid or Rituxan question after 4 years MCL can only be detected using sensitive flow technology. So probably both Dr. Kyle and Dr. Hoppeman would want to comment on this, and again, in a general way.
So I'm not quite sure what the question was there, Carolyn.
But the question, yeah, it's an online question, so I'm assuming that the question is, after 4 years, MCL can only be detected using sensitive flow technology. So I would, the question may then involve whether indeed the MCL is active in remission.
I'll try to answer that in a general way, and this might be worth spending just a minute on the whole idea of what's called minimal residual disease, and the acronym for that is MRD. So folks are probably going to start hearing more about MRD. And what these things are really getting at is how hard you're going to look for residual mantle cell lymphoma in an individual. So we have these terms like partial remission, complete remission, and now we have complete remission that is MRD positive, meaning complete remission means we can't see the disease on a scan, but with really sensitive tests of the blood or the bone marrow, we can find, say, one mantle cell out of every 100,000 cells we look at. Those are the sorts of levels that we're now getting to that we can look at. We can find one mantle cell out of every 100,000 cells that we look at in the blood or the bone marrow. And then you will get some patients who are in a complete remission who are MRD negative. MRD negative, meaning we looked at 100,000 cells and we couldn't find one mantle cell. Okay, well, that's a very deep remission. That's a fabulous remission. However, next year, someone could come along with a technology that can look at 1 in a million cells. So the patient who was MRD negative by the first assay may be MRD positive by the second assay, because instead of looking at 100,000 cells for one mantle cell, you're looking at 1 million cells for one mantle cell. So this is a way of measuring the depth of the remission. And it's a fast-moving field. Technology is really advancing this field, and we're getting better ability to look deeply inside of patients to see how deep the remission is. And we hope to take advantage of this knowledge to figure out when is a reasonable time to stop certain treatments or to triage patients to other sorts of treatments. And there's a whole host of studies that are being developed right now trying to make treatment decisions based upon MRD information that we're getting from patients. But as part of routine practice right now, these MRD assessments are not something that we're typically doing routinely in routine care to make treatment decisions. We're just not quite there yet. We don't know exactly what to do with this information yet.
Thank you. Dr. Hoffman, did you want to?
No, I think that covers that very well. I think the other issue that we really haven't talked about is the financial implications of these kinds of treatments and expense. And 4 years of lenalidomide and rituximab is significant. And so we're trying to find other ways to assess these responses, such as the way Brad has very articulately outlined the whole concept of MRD to help us manage and treat patients with these agents.
Thank you. And actually, Ms. Roman, do you want to comment on the financial aspects of the practical financial aspects of treatments that Cancer has programs for, or the Research Foundation has? Many of these organizations have programs to help with some of those, not all the costs, but for somehow to help in some way with those costs.
Absolutely. We do offer Cancer Care, does offer financial assistance for transportation, home care, or child care. And we will also try and link the patient with other resources for copay assistance with any financial needs that they might have. All you would need to do is call our helpline at 1-800-813-4673, and we'll explore that with you.
I think that there are many, and then our staff can help link you to other organizations. I think we've heard the Lymphoma Research Foundation is certainly a wonderful resource. The Leukemia Lymphoma Society also, there are organizations out there that do have funds to help. But again, it may not cover everything, but for many people it can be very helpful. It can help with transportation to treatment. So there are a lot of different ways that, that we can help. There is another question I'm going to ask Dr. Haberman to start with this. Some doctors offer ibrutinib frontline for MCL off-label. There's a concern of ibrutinib resistance and poor prognosis after ibrutinib fails. One doctor told me this only applies to relapsed refractory use of ibrutinib, but this would not be the case using ibrutinib frontline. Can you please comment on this?
Well, I think it's akin to the previous question, very similar, and we honestly don't know. And it's of significant concern. The international workshop meeting, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, this issue came up, and around the room were leading people internationally in the think-tank atmosphere. And I think the general statement can be made that this is a concern, but we really don't know. And therefore, because, I mean, I now have patients who literally were on 4 clinical trials who are out for more than 15 years because this is a disease of continued relapse. And there's so many things that can be done. If we had a curative agent up front, this is a whole other question potentially, but if you look at a drug like ibrutinib, the overall response rates are in the 68-69% rate in the relapse refractory setting, but the complete, the majority of them are partial remissions, not complete remissions. And so this means you need to be on the drug a long period of time, and that secondly, if we don't know or even have a sense of the potential risk of really becoming refractory after just one drug, there is concern. And if this is true, this is kind of unique. I've been involved in 21 drugs before their FDA approval, some of which have gotten FDA approved. And to me, this is a very unique story in 2016 and 2017, and I think we have to wait it out a little bit to understand it better.
Excellent, thank you. We have one last late-breaking question we're going to take. So how would you compare standard rituximab infusion with subcutaneous injection of rituximab? So Dr. Carl, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I don't have any personal experience with subcutaneous rituximab. There's something in the back of my head thinks it might have been approved recently in Europe, subcutaneous rituximab. But I know the companies who make it have been trying to develop this for a long time. The advantage would be a convenience issue from the standpoint of going in to a clinic and getting the subcutaneous injection, which would just take a few minutes as opposed to sitting there for 90 minutes or longer getting the infusion. So it would result in substantially less time having to be spent at the office for the patient if they're able to receive the drug subcutaneously.
Dr. Haberman, do you want to comment as well?
People have been trying to develop a subcutaneous type of rituximab or variant, and I do believe it did get FDA approved, I think, in Europe and some countries at least. And I think the short and long answer is we don't have enough cumulative data to understand. I actually wrote the original protocol for the RCHOP for the United States in 1992, so I've been around rituximab for a little while and is on both the FDA-approved trials in the United States, and the answer is that we don't know. Rituximab is going to go off patent this year or next year, which is also a stimulus to have other different products.
I want to thank our speakers. You have all been extraordinary. I've just been amazing. I think all of you, you can't hear us all applauding, but you've been really extraordinary. And I want to thank all of you who've asked really such very informed questions, really excellent questions. And we hope that the information you received is helpful to all of you. We also, in concluding the call today, we know that you may have some questions that you didn't get to ask. So I do want to actually, first of all, let you know where you can get some of those questions answered, first of all. So if you should have a medical question that you didn't get answered, I always recommend certainly contacting the Lymphoma Research Foundation. It's a wonderful resource, and their 800 number is 1-800-500-9976. And then the other place also to call is the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. And if you'd like to speak with one of our oncology social workers at Cancer Care, then please call us at Cancer Care if you want to just join a support group, want some practical assistance, want some counseling service. Definitely then call us at 1-800-813-4673. And most importantly, as we conclude today, I wouldn't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with mantle cell lymphoma or any type of hematologic cancer or cancer in general. Please do know that you can contact Cancer Care. Our staff are here to help you and to be a resource to all of you and to provide you with ongoing support. So I want to thank everyone for your participation today. I hope you'll take the information you learned back to your treating healthcare team. They know you, of course, the best, and if they can help to interpret any information you've gotten or any questions, further questions you may have. And I want to thank each one of you for your participation today and wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.